Today is Friday, October 15th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. Defense Secretary heads to Europe amid Russia concerns.
Stops will include Georgia, Ukraine, Romania, and he will conclude this important visit with allies and partners in Brussels for the NATO defense ministerial.
Plus, President Biden expresses optimism in COVID fight.
Nationally, daily cases are down 47%. Hospitalizations are down 38% over the past 6 weeks.
Also, researchers in Netherlands develop, quote, painless, unquote, injections without needles. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Blasts tore through a Shiite mosque in the southern Afghan city of Kandahar during Friday prayers, killing at least 32 people and injuring 53 others. The cause of the explosion was not immediately clear, but it came a week after a suicide attack on Shiite worshippers at a mosque in the northern city of Kunduz that was claimed by the Islamic State group. A doctor at the city's Central Mawares Hospital told the French news agency AFP, quote, 32 bodies and 53 wounded people have been brought to our hospital so far, unquote. Other medical sources and a provincial official confirmed a toll of more than 30, and at least 15 ambulances were rushing to and from the scene. A witness told AFP he heard three explosions, one at the main door of the mosque, another at a southern area, and a third where worshippers washed before their prayers. Another witness also said three blasts rocked the mosque in the center of the town during Friday prayers, the busiest congregation of the week. U.S. Secretary of State Lloyd Austin heads to Europe next week for talks with allies concerning about Russia and what the NATO military alliance will focus on now that the withdrawal from Afghanistan is complete. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Barb reports.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin travels to Europe next week in an effort to strengthen relations with allies.
Stops will include Georgia, Ukraine, and Romania, and he will conclude this important visit with allies and partners in Brussels for the NATO defense ministerial.
Georgia, Ukraine, and Romania all border the Black Sea, Russia's warm water entryway into the important trade routes of the Mediterranean Sea. Romania is a NATO ally, and Ukraine and Georgia aspire to join NATO. Both are partly occupied by Russian or Russian-backed forces, putting them squarely on the front lines against Moscow's aggression.
It's important for senior American leaders to go to Georgia and Ukraine and tell the people there, the free people of those two countries struggling against Russian invasion and occupation, that we have not forgotten, that we want to support them, and that when an authoritarian bully invades a democratic neighbor, that America is not neutral.
For years, the Pentagon has been trying to shift its focus toward potential adversaries Russia and China. And Bowman says the U.S. must have the military allies and capabilities in place in case both aggressors try to pick a fight.
China and Russia are more aligned than they have been since the 1950s. And so it's not inconceivable that the United States and our partners and allies could confront simultaneous aggression from China and Russia on opposite sides of the world.
America's leadership role has come under fire after the way the war in Afghanistan ended in August. The Taliban, the enemy of Afghan and international troops for two decades, are back in power, and several hard-fought societal gains have been eroded. Defense officials tell VOA that Secretary Austin and NATO allies will discuss next week where to put their military focus now that NATO troops are out of Afghanistan. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
The European envoy coordinating talks on the reviving the Iran nuclear deal, Enrique Mora, met with members of Iran's nuclear negotiating team on Thursday. The meetings took place 4 months after talks broke off between Iran and world powers, including the United States, to rescue the accord. The Islamic Republic has said it will return to the negotiations, quote, soon, unquote, without giving any sense of what that means. Western diplomats have tentatively said a return to the Vienna talks may be possible before the end of October. Since the former U.S. President Donald Trump ditched the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran, Tehran has been rebuilding stockpiles of enriched uranium, refining it to higher levels of purity, and installing advanced centrifuges to speed up enrichment. President Joe Biden aims to restore the deal to restrain Iran's nuclear program, but his sides disagree on which steps need to be taken and when. Diplomats have said they are concerned Tehran's new negotiating team under a president known as anti-Western hardliner, unlike his pragmatic predecessor, may make new demands beyond the scope of what had already been agreed. President Joe Biden on Thursday expressed optimism about the progress the U.S. has made against COVID-19. Recent polls have shown that his standing with the American public is entwined with the state of the pandemic in the country. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widasquara has more.
With his legislative agenda on infrastructure and social spending in limbo, on Thursday, President Joe Biden touted progress in the country's fight against the pandemic.
Nationally, daily cases are down 47%. Hospitalizations are down 38% over the past 6 weeks. Over the past 2 weeks, most of the country has improved as well. Case rates are declining in 39 states, and hospital rates are declining in 38 states.
Assuring Americans that his administration is succeeding in the fight against the pandemic is key to Biden's political viability. Chris Jackson is head of polling at Ipsos.
When the vaccine effort was being pretty successful in the spring, we saw his favorability numbers continue to be pretty high. But with the Delta variant and the spike in cases and sort of the resurgence in COVID we've seen over the last couple of months, we've seen Biden losing ground.
The withdrawal from Afghanistan, rising gas prices and inflation, and the surge of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border are contributing factors to Biden's poll numbers sliding. But pollsters say the pandemic is the key driver. 49.7% of Americans disapprove of the job Biden is doing, compared with 44.7% who approve, according to 538's presidential approval tracker. His poll numbers have been below 50% for a while. Since August 30th, more Americans have disapproved of the president than have approved of him. It's a bad sign for Democrats as the country heads into the 2022 midterm elections, said Republican pollster Whit Ayers.
The midterm elections are usually a referendum on the current administration. So it makes a huge difference for Republican fortunes if Joe Biden's job approval is 55 versus 35.
The White House has blamed COVID case numbers in part to Republicans' resistance to public health measures, including Republican governors blocking Biden's mandate requiring vaccination or weekly testing for employees of large companies, federal workers, and contractors. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Governor Abbott's executive order banning mandates, and I would also note announcement by Governor DeSantis this morning, essentially banning the implementation of mandates. Fit a familiar pattern that we've seen of putting politics ahead of public health.
Pollsters say voters don't care who is at fault. Again, Chris Jackson of Ipsos.
For a lot of Americans, they don't feel like COVID's under control. Why that's happened isn't necessarily material. Biden's the president, so Biden's responsible at the end of the day.
Biden again pleaded for the 66 million unvaccinated Americans to get their shots and called on businesses to step up and back his vaccine mandates. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Researchers in the Netherlands are developing laser technology to enable, quote, virtual painless, unquote, injections without needles in what they call a breakthrough that will ease fear and lower the threshold for vaccinations. The, quote, bubble gun, unquote, uses a laser to push tiny droplets through the outer layer of the skin, said David Fernandez-Rivas, a professor of 20 university and research affiliate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who developed the technology. The process is quicker than a mosquito bite, unquote, should not cause pain, unquote, because nerve endings in the skin are not touched, he said, adding, this will be studied further. It could, however, take 1 or 3 years for the method to be available to the general public, depending on the progress of research and regulatory issues.
The needle-free injection technology we are developing is very important because by removing the needle, many people who are afraid of being vaccinated will take the vaccine at this moment. We do that by accelerating small droplets of liquid that penetrate in the superficial layer of the skin, and this has many advantages. The first one is removing the fear. Additionally, we contaminate a lot by the needles that are used, and our immune system works very well when you inject into these superficial layers of the skin. So within a millisecond, the glass that contains the liquid is heated by a laser. A bubble is created in the liquid, pushing the liquid at velocities on the order of 100 kilometers per hour. And we can see the gelatin, how it penetrates about 1 millimeter approximately.
That's David Fernandez-Rivas, a professor of 20 university and research affiliate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. A new World Health Organization initiative is getting underway in Africa to rapidly detect COVID-19 infections to curb transmission and contain future flare-ups of this deadly disease. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
The WHO reports more than 8.4 million cases of COVID-19 in Africa, including 214,000 deaths. However, a new analysis indicates the magnitude of the pandemic on the continent is greatly underestimated. The assessment finds only 1 in 7 COVID-19 infections is being detected, meaning the true number of cases in Africa could be around 59 million. It estimates a lesser number of deaths, 1 in 3, is being reported. Given the low vaccination rates on the continent, WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says it is vitally important to know where and how the virus is circulating in communities. Currently, only 4.4% of the 1.2 billion population is fully vaccinated.
With limited testing, we're still flying blind in far too many communities in Africa. Most tests are carried out on people with symptoms, but much of the transmission is driven by asymptomatic people. Estimates suggest that between 65 and 85% of COVID-19 cases are asymptomatic. The reported cases we see could therefore just be the tip of the iceberg.
Moeti says the WHO's community testing initiative is a radically new approach and one that should help raise detection rates significantly. She says the WHO is providing $1.8 million to kick off the implementation in the 8 countries taking part in the pilot project: Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Guinea-Bissau, Ivory Coast, Mozambique, the Republic of Congo, Senegal, and Zambia.
Local authorities in hotspot districts will use antigen detection rapid diagnostic tests, which are reliable, affordable, easy to use, and provide results in around 15 minutes so that individuals can quickly know their status. It's expected that more than 7 million people will be tested through this new initiative, increasing the testing capacity in each participating country by 40%.
Moeti warns end-of-the-year celebrations could usher in a fourth wave of the coronavirus across Africa and the globe. She urges wealthy countries that have vaccinated around two-thirds of their populations to share their surplus doses now with people in Africa rather than next year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Australian city of Sydney will allow the entry of fully vaccinated travelers from overseas from November 1st without the need for quarantine, authorities said on Friday. Flora Bradley-Watson of Reuters reports.
The Australian city of Sydney announced plans on Friday to let in fully vaccinated travelers from overseas. Up until now, thousands of Australians living abroad have been unable to return home because of a strict cap on arrivals. The plans are set to come into effect from next month, and will also mean that new arrivals will not need to quarantine. Following the announcement, Prime Minister Scott Morrison stressed that initially it would just be Australian citizens and permanent residents who will benefit.
We're not opening up to everyone coming back to Australia at the moment. I want to be clear about that. We're going to take this forward in a staged and careful way, as we've done all of these things.
The decision comes as New South Wales state, of which Sydney is capital, is expected to reach an 80% first vaccination dose rate on Saturday. On the streets of Sydney, many agreed it was time to live with COVID-19, but some were worried the move was too abrupt.
I think, yes, we should let people in if they're double vaccinated, tested negative, but I'm a bit concerned that you go from 2 weeks hotel quarantine to zero quarantine, you know, at least maybe a few days at home.
It is good. Maybe a few months ago, I would have thought it's a bit scary, but it's been so long for so many people. We need to be reunited with our families.
Qantas Airways is now bringing forward the restart of international flights from Sydney to London and Los Angeles by 2 weeks to November the 1st. It's also considering bringing forward the resumption of flights from some other places that have been expected in December.
That's Flora Bradley-Watson of Reuters. Also on Friday, the White House said it will lift entry restrictions on fully vaccinated foreign citizens starting November 8th. This is the Voice of America. Southeast Asia's top diplomats will discuss in an emergency meeting Friday whether to allow Myanmar's military leader to attend an annual summit after a crisis envoy was barred from meeting ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations appointed Brunei's Erwan Yusof to mediate an end to the Myanmar crisis, but he canceled his trip this week after learning he couldn't meet Suu Kyi and others. British lawmaker David Amis has died after he was stabbed several times Friday at a church where he was holding a regular weekly meeting with his constituents. A local official told Reuters the wound looked serious. Amis is a member of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party. Several British politicians have been attacked in the past decade, including Joe Cox, a Labour Party member of parliament who was murdered in 2016. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. On October 14, 2017, a truck bomb exploded at a busy intersection in Mogadishu, killing 587 people and injuring almost 1,000 more. 4 years later, the scars of the attack are still seen and felt in the capital city, as Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu.
Today, the intersection is known as October 14 Junction, and a monument marks the spot where the bomb blew up at buildings and ended so many lives. Most of the buildings at the former Sobe Junction have been rebuilt, but 4 years after the blast, some lots are still covered in rubble, a reminder of the destruction the blast has caused. The blast also ripped apart hundreds of families who lost relatives and close friends. Farmer Hassan Yusuf is one who still feels the repercussions. She says she lost her close friend Ayan Mohammed, who was an important pillar in her family, adding that Mohammed's body, together with another friend, was discovered later. She says Ayan informed her about imminent security threat in the city 1 week before the attack in order to stay indoors, but unfortunately lost her own life. Stationery shop owner Hassan Abdullahi is a resilient man who was wounded in the blast. Despite the horror he experienced, he's now back at his renovated shop. He said it was an unexpected painful day when he was admitted to hospital for 3 weeks after sustaining a neck injury. He said he's now happy to be back conducting his business at the same location where hundreds died 4 years ago. No one claimed the responsibility for the horrific attack, but the government blamed it on the militant group Al-Shabaab. In February 2018, a Somali military court convicted 20-year-old Hassan Adan Isak for leading the Al-Shabaab unit, said to have carried out the attack. He was executed that October. Another man was sentenced to death in absentia. A statement Thursday from the president's office appealed to the citizens to support the efforts by security agencies to help eradicate terrorist activities. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
At least 5 people were killed and 16 wounded as shots were fired during a protest by Iran-backed Hezbollah supporters who were denouncing Tariq Bitta, the judge investigating 2020 Beirut port blast. Explosions were also heard Thursday as tensions over the politically charged case pushed Lebanon into another crisis. The Lebanese army is searching for the gunman. For VOA, Dave Gablak reports from Amman.
Interior Minister Bassem Malawi pointed to a worrying development, saying many of the casualties from the eruption of gunfire in Beirut were by snipers from the buildings. This is a very dangerous sign, Malawi told reporters. No one can take this. Joseph Bahut directs the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut and lives near the scene of the shootings. He tells VOA that the bursts of gunfire and the wail of ambulance sirens made him feel like he was reliving scenes from Lebanon's civil war of 1975 to 1990.
Today, it's probably a very explosive situation. The country is now on the verge of maybe something very grave. If really what we hear so far is confirmed that there are snipers on the rooftops that are shooting at both parties protesting in the street, this could really resemble the start of 75 in Lebanon.
At a nearby school, teachers instructed students to lie face down on the ground with their hands on their heads, a witness told Reuters. Behut warned that the violence, which broke out in an area dividing Christian and Shiite Muslim neighborhoods, a former front line of the 1975 to 1990 civil war, could sideline the probe into last year's catastrophic Beirut port blast that left more than 200 dead and destroyed vast parts of the capital.
We are on a very slippy terrain. And my fear is that the issue of the port inquiry will become soon one of many other crises in the country. This question will become very unfortunately concealed and secondary compared to what is happening since this morning in the streets of Beirut, the clashes, the firing, the sniping. Increasingly, the debate will shift to what happened this morning, who started the shooting, who shot whom. I fear the issue of the port will soon be, in a way, submerged and maybe aside.
Judge Tariq Bitar has faced enormous pressure from former ministers linked to Hezbollah, Lebanon's power broker, and from its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, who accuse him of singling out their political allies for questioning in the probe. They have been trying to stop his investigation into the August 4, 2020 Beirut port blast, one of the biggest non-nuclear explosions in history. Reports said a huge quantity of ammonium nitrate, commonly used to make fertilizer or bombs, was left unsafely stored there for years. Families of the port blast victims have warned against replacing or intimidating Bitar, no matter how high the threat level, telling officials to keep their hands off the judiciary. Analyst Joseph Bahut says Prime Minister Najib Makati's new government now faces a fresh sectarian challenge on top of trying to rescue the country from economic collapse and an energy crisis. Some political leaders say that an international investigation into the blast may be needed because Hezbollah is threatened by a probe pointing at it. Dil Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
The world's most famous, quote, starship captain, unquote, takes the trek of a lifetime. Plus, new software makes possible virtual trips through the universe, and a mining company in Greenland offers a potentially planet-saving alternative to aluminum. VOA's Arash Rabasadi brings us the week in space.
Oh, Jesus.
This week, about 55 years after William Shatner made famous the character of Captain James T. Kirk on the 1960s TV show Star Trek, he made history once again. The 90-year-old Shatner became the oldest person in space when he and his three crewmates rode the Blue Origin rocket owned by billionaire Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. The crew experienced 3 to 4 minutes of weightlessness flying 100 kilometers above Earth on the autonomous craft before landing back in Texas under a cloud of dust.
Welcome back.
Blue Origin, along with the Elon Musk-owned SpaceX and Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic, are the frontrunners in the space tourism industry. But here in West Texas, space tourism has another meaning.
This is a big deal for our town in terms of tourism. You know, the hotels are filling up, the restaurants are staying busy, the gas stations are staying busy, more so than usual. We have pretty good traffic through here, but we're wanting people to come in and stay for a while.
Mayor Brewster added that for fans of science fiction, her town is a place to see fantasy become reality. Meanwhile, researchers at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology Lausanne plan this week to release their own work of science fiction. They've collected what they call the largest data set of the universe in an open-source software for virtual space exploration. 3D glasses are necessary for the full experience, but a computer screen is good enough for two dimensions. The software is set for release on Tuesday. Finally this week, a mining company in Greenland says a local rock can help address some of our planet's climate change concerns. The company, Greenland Anorthosite Mining, says anorthosite is an alternative to aluminum. Aluminum production is energy intensive, while anorthosite is considered low impact. The rock is similar to that brought back from the moon in the Apollo missions, and NASA is already testing its dust to see what can eventually be built on and mined from the moon. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
The husband of Olympic runner Agnes Tirop has been arrested and will be charged with her murder after Kenyan police launched a nationwide manhunt. Authorities say Ibrahim Rotish was apprehended in the coastal city of Mombasa while trying to flee the country. He was arrested after crashing his vehicle into a truck in a car chase with police and escaping a first attempt by officers to apprehend him. Tirop was found stabbed to death on Wednesday at her home in the western town of Iten. She was a two-time World Championship bronze medalist and finished fourth in the 5,000 meters at the Tokyo Olympics. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nania Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofori in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. and have a pleasant weekend.